Today is Tuesday, September 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Both U.S. presidential candidates addressed climate change when speaking about the wildfires raging in the western U.S. What's it like to live there?
With every breath and looking at the air, we're just aware in a breath-by-breath way of the suffering that's happening.
Plus, why is British Prime Minister Boris Johnson willing to break international law and force a hard Brexit?
And he says it's vital that as a sovereign nation, Britain overrides this withdrawal agreement now.
We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump and his Democratic challenger in the upcoming November national election, former Vice President Joe Biden, focused on Monday on historic destructive wildfires on the West Coast. Biden attacked the president's view on climate change in his remarks.
Donald Trump's climate denial may not have caused these fires and record floods and record hurricanes, but if he gets a second term, these hellish events will continue to become more common, more devastating, and more deadly.
President Trump sparred with California state officials on whether climate change or forest management was to blame for the wildfires raging in the West during a briefing on the crisis Monday.
You know, forest management is not only the leaves that have been sitting there for many years that are dry as a bone, but they're also the trees that go over. Anytime, anything over 18 months, that is like a matchstick. It's absolutely like a matchstick. And the standing trees, as you know, they're taking in water. They're wet, and they're much harder to catch.
VOA Silicon Bureau Chief Michelle Quinn is based in San Francisco, California, and I spoke to her Monday evening about the ongoing destruction.
You know, there's 3 to 5 states that are being affected. I just saw that Idaho is affected. So just specifically in California, there's 28 fires. They've burned about, so far in California, 13,000 square kilometers. 4,000 some structures are gone. That's housing and other structures, and more than 24 fatalities. That's just in California. And all these fires are at different levels, what we call here, now we know the terminology, containment. So some are nearing almost 100% containment, meaning that they basically have solved the problem and the firefighters are winning. Some have zero containment.
With some of these bigger fires that are at zero containment, have they released any information about how they're going to go about and tackle that problem? Because it's not only that the fires are burning, but you have dry conditions, you have wind coming through the area.
Right. And then that's the problem is, at some level, yes, you have to fight the fire, but you can't fight it if the situation is too hazardous. So some standard things that firefighters do here and that they're doing for these bigger fires is they're creating backburns where they're lighting a fire to kind of create some wind so that it doesn't burn forward as much. I'm not as familiar with the science of backburns, but there's some places where it's burning where it burned last year. So the firefighters are trying to direct the fires to places that already burned, which are smaller, have less brush, and easier to manage.
You know, this is yet another fire in California and the West. You know, what is it like living through something like this, especially now during the pandemic?
You know, it's been very interesting. I mean, in a way, we've learned a lot the past 3 years. And the first big one that happened in Northern California was 3 years ago. You know, the state often has fires, but they're mostly in arid Southern California. So the surprise has been Northern California. Now the surprise this time has been how ferocious, and then also Oregon, our neighbor to the north, and our neighbors Washington, even further north, places that are kind of like rainforests are getting burned. The pandemic, I mean, that's a little bit of a new twist this year as well, which is that we can't just go to the gym and know that we can breathe the air in there, or to a movie theater or a mall or a restaurant, that we're really limited, particularly in the state, from going anywhere. So that's also another layer to this. But I think this is, you know, what the weird thing is that I don't feel, and people in my town don't feel personally in danger of here, but we're with every breath and looking at the air, we're just aware in a breath-by-breath way of the suffering that's happening in our state, in the whole West. And it makes you think, you know, what is causing this, and what is my role as an individual in making this better?
Michelle Quinn is VOA's Silicon Valley Bureau Chief. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Monday granted a $1.5 billion loan to Belarus as a show of support for its embattled leader, Alexander Lukashenko, after weeks of street demonstrations that have accused him of rigging last month's election to retain power in Minsk. Meanwhile, Putin's United Russia Party scored an overwhelming victory in local elections Sunday, though opposition candidates made gains in Siberia. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to journalist Charles Maines in Moscow.
We've seen a wave of demonstrations against Lukashenko's calling for his resignation ever since a contested August 9th presidential election that Lukashenko insists he won in a landslide. We saw another huge protest on Sunday, a slightly smaller one the day before. But on Sunday, over 100,000 demonstrators marched in the capital, Minsk, and of course, demonstrators in other cities of Belarus. This is for the fourth straight weekend in a row. So ever since this election, people have been coming out insisting this was a rigged election to keep Lukashenko in power. And you saw Lukashenko's security forces try and keep these protests under control. They were trying to pick off protesters as they were making their way towards the city center, and they just got swamped. And when there were reports of over 700 arrests, but in the face of 100,000-plus protesters, it didn't seem to make much of a difference.
The UN Human Rights Council in Geneva has agreed today to take a look at the situation in Belarus. Can you tell us about that?
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is looking into these cases of police violence. We saw this police crackdown in the wake of the vote. We've had over 7,000 arrests, again, 700 just on Sunday. And more worrisome than even just the arrests themselves is this really, really grim portrait that people who come out of the prisons present of being beaten by police, of being tortured by police. So there are real concerns there. You know, at this point, Vladimir Putin has given essentially lukewarm support for the security forces in Belarus, saying that they've conducted themselves with some restraint. I think most people would probably find that hard to believe, given some of the evidence that's come out. Mr. Lukashenko, he says that the protesters have been painting these bruises on their bodies, that none of this was real. Lukashenko comes arguing that these protests are part of, you know, essentially a Western plot to, one, dethrone him and also expand NATO to Russia's borders and possibly beyond. And this is a pretty naked attempt to try and draw Russia into this, essentially what should be a domestic debate within Belarus, that he lost an election in the eyes of these of the opposition. And so what he's trying to do at this point is see if he can sort of get Russia involved in this bigger East-West standoff. It's an open question how successful he'll be, although it's important also to point out that Vladimir Putin is no fan of street revolutions. He's no fan of overturning the powers that be through the ballot box. He's also been in power for 20-some years. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics at play here in Sochi, and we'll have to see how they shake out.
Now, there's also politics happening in Russia. In particular, there were local elections which took place Sunday. What's happened there?
It was a three-day election cycle this time because of concerns of the coronavirus, although observers would say that also opened the door to a lot of violations, whether it's ballot stuffing or early voting that seemed unrealistically high. Candidates tied to the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, who was stricken by poisoning, is now recovering in a German hospital. They won some key races in Siberia. That was an interesting dynamic. But the overall message seemed to be this kind of overwhelming victory for pro-Kremlin candidates in the governorships and the powerful governorships, which would seem to point, kind of seem in the face of, fly in the face of logic, in the sense that, you know, we've seen falling polling numbers. We've seen the government struggle, a lot of unhappiness over the economy. And what was interesting here is to see the governors in six cases in particular scoring ratings victories that matched Lukashenko's in Belarus. They got over 80% of the vote.
Charles Maines reports from Moscow, and he was speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson won the first of several votes in Parliament on his plan to undercut the Brexit treaty, though he faces a growing rebellion among lawmakers who say breaking international law would tarnish Britain's reputation. Johnson made his case earlier in the day.
I regret to have to tell the House that in recent months, the EU has suggested that it is willing to go to extreme and unreasonable lengths, using the Northern Ireland Protocol in a way that goes well beyond common sense, simply to exert leverage against the UK in our negotiations for a free trade agreement.
But why is Johnson putting Britain in a position where it could break international law? For that, I spoke with Henry Ridgewell in London.
He says that the withdrawal agreement and that clause about the Northern Ireland Protocol, as it's known, was only there in case nothing worked out. And he says it's vital that as a sovereign nation, Britain overrides this withdrawal agreement now and sort of maintains the union and prevents the breakup of the union. It goes back to Parliament for a second reading next week, and that's where the problems could arise for Boris Johnson. Some big names in the Conservative Party have already said they won't be voting for it. The former Chancellor, Sajid Javid, the former Attorney General, no less, Geoffrey Cox, who was a big name this time a year ago when the EU withdrawal agreement was going through Parliament. So many more junior MPs will follow their lead, and we could, in a week's time, be talking about the first possible defeat for this government of Boris Johnson.
And not only that, on Sunday, former prime ministers also came out saying that this deal would, you know, create problems for that border in Ireland and could conceivably, you know, see a rise in violence again.
That's right. Now, five former prime ministers have come forward and voiced their objections to it, the latest today being David Cameron. Their concerns extend not only to the impact on the negotiations with the European Union and the impact on Northern Ireland, the Northern Ireland Protocol and the border there, but also in a much wider sense, in terms of Britain's reputation around the world, in terms of a government admitting that it's prepared to break international law, to prepared to go against the terms of a treaty that it signed less than a year ago. And when Britain goes to the United Nations Security Council or voices its objections to the actions of China, perhaps in Hong Kong or Russia, with its persecution of opposition figures and so on, the fear is that they can then point to Britain and say, well, you don't respect international law either, and you've admitted so much. So this is all about really the reputation of Britain around the world as it tries to forge itself a new role, as it leaves the European Union and tries to step onto the world stage as a player on its own. And many MPs believe this is not a good start, although Boris Johnson says this new piece of legislation is vital to maintain the sovereignty of the United Kingdom.
Brexit, of course, narrowly passed. So what's been the reaction among those in Britain to this latest development?
There is, I think, a level of fatigue with the complexity of the debate and the inability to move beyond any of these sort of very legislative issues. I don't think there's a huge amount of engagement with the substance. There is an understanding that Britain has admitted it's about to break international law if this bill goes through, and there is some objections to that. There is no polling so far that I'm aware of that has measured public feeling on this. But I think actually people are so distracted and worried about the coronavirus outbreak. We've just had new restrictions brought in Monday on restrictions on the size of gatherings and so on. So I think they want the government to get on and deal with the coronavirus crisis without having another distraction. And the major fear is that the Brexit transition period ends at the end of this year on December the 31st. Doctors in this country are predicting a possible major second wave as the winter approaches, and we could have these two crises collide with each other, a no-deal Brexit and a coronavirus second wave. So there's a lot of concern about what is going on, and it is, I think, incumbent upon the government to explain to the population how it's going to deal with this and where the Brexit process is going.
Henry Ridgewell reports from London. The United Nations Human Rights Office reports that the Myanmar military continues to attack, persecute, and commit gross violations against the Rohingya Muslims 3 years after similar actions triggered a mass exodus of more than 750,000 Rohingya to Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. The report has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council, and Lisa Schlein takes things from here.
Myanmar military operations 3 years ago have created a terrible human rights crisis, which is far from being resolved. A UN fact-finding mission in 2019 concluded many of the violations by the military amounted to crimes against humanity, in some cases bordering on genocide. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet says the Rohingya and other minorities are increasingly victimized by the armed conflict in Rakhine and Chin states. She says civilians are subject to disappearances and extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, torture, and deaths in custody.
Civilian casualties have also been increasing. In some cases, they appear to have been targeted or attacked indiscriminately, which may constitute further war crimes or even crimes against humanity. It is troubling that a number of satellite images and eyewitness accounts indicate that areas in northern Rakhine have been burned in recent months.
Bachelet notes, Myanmar has said repeatedly it wants to resolve the Rohingya crisis and ensure refugees can return to their places of origin in dignity and safety. She says the government must act now to make this happen by ending the serious violations against the Rohingya people. Myanmar's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Kyaw Moe Tun, blames the 2017 exodus of the Rohingya on terrorist attacks. He says they were deliberate attempts to derail efforts to find a solution to Rakhine. He says the government fully shares the concerns of all affected communities and is willing and able to address the issue of accountability. The ambassador says his government is working closely with various UN agencies and ASEAN to implement the bilateral agreement between Myanmar and Bangladesh on the repatriation, resettlement, and development of Rohingya returnees to Rakhine State. The chair of the advisory board of Progressive Voice, a local Myanmar human rights research and advocacy organization, is not persuaded by the ambassador's conciliatory tone. Ken Omar says the civil war in Myanmar has reached an intensity not seen in decades, with immense consequences on the local ethnic communities. She calls a government peace conference held in August meaningless.
The failure of the peace process is marked by the ongoing grave international crimes that continue to be committed throughout Myanmar, particularly in Rakhine State, by the same perpetrators that committed genocide against the Rohingya. Yet no one is being held to account, and the Myanmar military continues to act with total impunity.
Omar is calling on the international community to cut its business ties with the military conglomerates and to impose a moratorium on arms transfer to Myanmar. She urges UN member states and the Security Council to refer Myanmar to the International Criminal Court or to establish an ad hoc tribunal. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And coming up later.
I think absolutely. You find a lot of workers now are not only readapting to telework, but there are people getting more and more skilled at it.
This is VOA News.
In a minute.
When a more massive star dies, its core collapses from tremendous gravity and forms a black hole. A star with less mass explodes in a supernova and becomes a neutron star. Scientists at the U.S. LIGO and Italy's Virgo collaborations have detected what they describe as an unusual gravitational wave signal. They say the signal was generated by the merger of a 2.6 solar mass object with a 23 solar mass black hole. The reason for the uncertainty of the first object was that it had a mass between the heaviest known neutron star, 2.5 solar masses, and the lightest known black hole, 5 solar masses. The scientists are trying to determine if the object was now the heaviest neutron star or the lightest black hole known to science. Details of the discovery were published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Prime Minister of Eastern Libya's interim government has resigned, following protests in several eastern Libyan towns and cities, including an attack on the headquarters of military commander General Khalifa Haftar over the weekend. Edward Uranian has more from Cairo.
A spokesman for Eastern Libya's interim prime minister, Abdullah Al-Thani, said he submitted his resignation to Parliament Speaker Aguila Sala, whose spokesman confirmed the resignation and indicated that it would be debated by MPs at a future session. The resignation came after popular protests in Benghazi and several other eastern Libyan cities over deteriorating living conditions, including long power cuts, water shortages, and a dearth of basic necessities. Libyan media with ties to Islamist militias showed video of what appeared to be a shooting in front of eastern Libyan military commander Khalifa Haftar's main headquarters in the town of Al-Marj. Some Libyan media claim that protesters stormed the compound. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. Haftar's spokesman, Colonel Ahmed al-Masmari, told Libyan TV that his forces support popular protests but urged protesters to demonstrate during the daytime so that they can be protected. Al-Masmari claimed that forces aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood and Takfiri groups were trying to sow chaos. The UN support mission in Libya issued a statement Sunday expressing grave concern over reports that one civilian was killed, three others wounded, and a number arrested after eastern Libyan forces used what it called excessive force against peaceful protesters. Popular protests against the UN-backed Government of National Accord in the capital of Tripoli reportedly left several people wounded earlier this month after forces there fired on crowds. Libya has been effectively split between rival eastern and western governments since 2015. In other developments, eastern Libyan military spokesman al-Masmari told Arab media that reports that Haftar promised U.S. ambassador to Libya Richard Norland that he would turn on the oil spigots again are being discussed and are tied to concerns that the government in Tripoli may use its share of oil money to pay for deals signed with Turkey. Libyan analyst Aya Berwaila, a visiting lecturer at the Hellenic Defense College, tells VOA that the crisis in eastern Libya can be blamed mostly on a budget shortfall, but that the interim government's resignation comes as a surprise to Libyans in that it shows it is responsive to its constituents and willing to take responsibility for its failures. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Paul Rusesabagina, portrayed as a hero in a Hollywood movie about Rwanda's 1994 genocide, declined to plead on Monday to all the 13 charges facing him, demanding that he be allowed to plead to each separate count in a case that has also thrust a spotlight onto President Paul Kagame's government. Rusesabagina, who once called for armed resistance to the government and on a YouTube video, appeared in a Kigali court accused of terrorism, complicity in murder, and forming or joining an irregular armed group, among other charges. His trial promises to be the most highly profile yet in a string of cases against Kagame's opponents. Greek authorities say three people have died and 56 have been rescued from the sea after a vessel carrying migrants sank off the southern island of Crete. The Coast Guard said it was unclear whether anybody was still missing, as the survivors were not in a position to give accurate numbers of how many people had been on board. A Greek naval frigate and an Air Force helicopter were taking part in the search, together with two Coast Guard boats and three merchant ships. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings says that he doesn't see his employees staying at home and ultimately wants them to return to the office to go to work. That's in contrast with other tech companies like Google, which has told its employees to plan on teleworking well into 2021. But in many parts of the world, the infrastructure just isn't there to do remote work on the scale that large companies may need moving forward. So what kind of information and knowledge gaps will that have on businesses moving forward? To get that answer, I spoke with Dominic Mizzarandino, the CEO of the Inquisitor.
I think absolutely. You find a lot of workers now are not only readapting to telework, but there are people getting more and more skilled at it. Maybe they're building their own home offices, they're buying the equipment, and more apt to how to deal with working remote. It seems to be almost a skill set within itself and thereby something monetizable in itself.
Now, the other half of this equation is that, you know, if you have the ability to telework, as you mentioned, you can develop these new skills. But there are parts, not only in the United States, but throughout the world, where the electronic infrastructure, the broadband infrastructure, isn't available. You do not have the ability to telework. A great example of this is I have a friend in the next state over who's on a farm, and he still can't even get DSL, let alone, you know, cable or Fios, you know, fiber optic broadband to his place. So what does it do to, you know, other nations in terms of developing their workforce if they don't have the ability to telework or develop these computerized skills?
Well, I think it's not just the skill set, as we're describing, but it's overall we're trying to learn it. In the sense, I'm just thinking how many times I've had employees of mine say that their internet's down. But certainly we also have to look in terms of a nation. You know, we're discussing Wi-Fi, national Wi-Fi, 5G. These are inherent functions that I think are becoming more vital, just like electricity and water. If you want to have a society that's working, you better have the infrastructure for it.
You know, one thing that also comes to mind is the necessity for physical space. I was speaking with an employee at an NGO here in Washington recently, and the company made the decision to forego the lease on their office space in Washington because of the pandemic. Everyone's remote working. But they do foresee a point in the near future, perhaps later on in the fall or early 2021, where some people will go back to the office. But they think that an office sharing solution where they don't have to have dedicated space is something that they'll need. Given that a lot of companies are seeing a benefit in remote working, do you see a migration away from dedicated physical, you know, space for offices to this kind of office sharing modality that some companies are looking at?
Yeah, certainly. I think that companies are going to start to see that benefit when that bottom line in terms of lease and rent starts to drop. There is certainly a need.
Is it just the bottom line, or is it, I mean, do you miss out on having a place that you can actually call your own, though?
100%. You miss out on that place, and that's a great point. And I think that they're finding and readapting to it. Now, COVID's different. You can't really fly. You can't, I have a team in Florida. How do I get from New York to Florida during COVID? But that said, when we've been telecommuting over the years before COVID, we would find a location, maybe it was a teleworkplace, and we'd rent a big conference room and we'd all work together. And it was really cheaper. The flight ticket, the hotel, and the conference room was cheaper than the maintenance on rent. I think that to me is more the model that we're going to go to. We're going to find those costs to form a meeting might be cheaper. And overall, that's how the company will basically function. Where are you flying? Where are we meeting? You and me have a meeting. Where are we going to be? You're in Virginia. I'm in New York. We'll meet in New Jersey. And, you know, life is beautiful from there. I think that's the model we're going to start to move more towards.
Dominic Mizzarandino is a remote working expert and the CEO of the Inquisitor. TikTok has chosen Oracle over Microsoft as its partner in the United States that could help keep the popular video sharing app running here, according to a source familiar with the deal. And AP's Julie Walker has more.
The Trump administration had threatened to ban TikTok by September 20th and ordered its parent company, ByteDance, to sell its U.S. business, claiming national security risks and spying concerns because it's Chinese-owned. TikTok denied the charge and sued the Trump administration at the same time it started discussions with possible U.S. partners. Microsoft said Sunday its bid was rejected. No word yet from Oracle or TikTok. I'm Julie Walker.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.